Before we start the show, we'd like to make a couple of disclaimers. This show covers a wide range of mental health topics, including suicide. So take care when listening. Check the show notes for organisations and people that can help. Also, while we discuss our own tips on staying well, this show is not meant to be a substitute for professional advice. Take care. Enjoy. Welcome to Bipolar and I, the podcast where me, David Alfie Ward, gets to tell my story about being a bipolar sufferer and what's the opposite word suffering, Lara?
Enjoyment.
Enjoyment. Bipolar enjoyment. Bloody love it. I'm not here alone. I'm here with a good friend of mine, the one and only Lara Cross.
Yeah, the one and only.
The one and only.
Got that right.
I got that right.
Yeah, you did.
So Lara has been there for me in the last 2 years when I needed her the most. And she wasn't actually in my life before that. You was kind of thrown in the deep end, weren't you, Lara?
Yeah, 100%. I love it in the deep end.
Lara came to one of my shows unwillingly. No, unwillingly to go to the show. But like, you didn't know that you was like, oh, there'll just be some comedians. And then you was like, oh, look at this guy. I bet he's going to be interesting to have in my life. Wrong.
No. Yeah. Well, it was actually the first comedy night I attended.
Ever. And whose idea was
first
it?
First and last.
Don't give me that.
And I don't know. It was like, I don't know. We just had nothing to do. So we were like, oh, we'll go see some comedy. And yeah.
It's weird how that's kind of fate has aligned us, because we've become very close in the last
year. Yeah, it is weird. And then you chatted me up.
Even if you'd gone to the late show, I don't know, I can't remember if it was the late or the, no, it was, you were at the late show because we went to the pub afterwards. But if you'd gone to the early show, you might not have seen me, or might not have chatted afterwards, because I'm not allowed, the comedy club owner says you're not allowed to go pub up between the two shows.
Oh, good.
Which was bang up, because one time I went to, there's one opposite, and I went there with name dropping, but I just name dropped. And we got rat arsed, and then we had to go back and do another show.
Very naughty.
Apparently that is unprofessional.
Mm.
But what happened is,
you saw me in the crowd and you were like, wow.
I mean, I can't, the spotlight hits. Mm. I can't see anybody in the crowd. This is a line that I continue to tell women to make them feel special. I can't see anybody, honestly. It's just, I can see the front row. No, I can pretty much see everybody. And then I went to the pub afterwards. I always used to go to Philomena's. Now, what you didn't realise, and what, you know, the other comedians didn't realise and stuff, was I tried to kill myself a month before.
Mm.
And I was very in denial about my mental health and what was happening to me in life.
Mm.
And I had this show booked in, and comedy has always been such an escape. And that was it. So I went to the pub, just pretending to be like this Jack the Lad kind of thing, but really I was going there because I wanted to drink the night away.
Mm.
I was always chasing the night at this stage of my life.
You did have that air about you.
What, like an alcoholic air?
No, just like,
this man buys a Lidl whiskey.
No, I mean just like you were looking for a good time.
There's a couple of Irish girls wouldn't leave me alone.
Yeah, exactly.
You swan the crud. These Irish girls wouldn't leave me alone. And then, like my guardian angel, you just came across. I remember you just palmed one of them out of the way. Get out of the way, this man. Oh, what is it? It's my turn to talk to him. And I said, oh, was you at my show? I didn't realise. And he was like, you fucking knew.
Nah, I denied that I was there.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right.
I was like, what? No? And you were like, oh, I'm a comedian. And I was like, oh, really? Okay. But honestly,
I knew that you was in my show, and you knew that you was in my show.
Yeah,
but we're both.
I knew because I saw you, and I was like, "Well, yeah, that's a bit of that." But then, yeah, you said, "Oh, I'm this comedian. I just did like Top Secret," and I was like, "Oh, okay, cool. Like, nice, yeah."
Big up Top Secret Comedy Club. Is the best comedy club in the world. For my money, anyway. I really love playing. I'm actually there this weekend, but that means nothing to the listeners, because by the time we put this out, it's not going to be this weekend. But just come and see me. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like,
yeah. And so that's it. That's how me and Lara know each other. Lara does work in mental health. Isn't there's a reason I've sat down with Lara. You know, she's not just somebody beyond that I enjoy her company with. What's that?
Beyond my looks and
beyond. Yeah, there's a whole reason that I've sat down with Lara, and it's because, you know, after that night of silliness and you know, flirting in the bar and stuff like that, Lara, then we started messaging each other. And then we went on a date while I was watching football. I had to make sure we went to a pub.
He took me on a date to watch his football team.
Listen.
I've come a long way because I would not be putting up with that these days.
If you want to go on a date with me.
Nah, shut up.
Yeah, you need to look at the Tottenham fixtures and work yourself around them. Yeah, that's not my fault.
Rude.
It's not my fault. And and then, but yeah, well, like we said, well, what you didn't realize at the time of meeting me, and what you didn't realize even, you know, a week or so later when we met again, was that I was pretty much almost dead behind the eyes in terms of my mental health. Mm. I was struggling. You know, I was having the worst time of my life. I remember, like, it was only about a month before that I tried to. So I'm going to go into that in later episodes. And I actually found some pictures of me from around that time. Actually, I interviewed a boxer called Ted Cheeseman.
Mm.
I took a selfie with him. I sent you the selfie, didn't I? And I took the selfie, and I'm just like, my eyes just glazed over. I was really, really suffering.
Mm.
And Lara does work in mental health. Do you want to introduce yourself and what you do?
Yeah, so I am in training to be a psychological wellbeing practitioner.
Yeah.
So I'm delivering, it sounds so professional. So I'm delivering CBT therapy to patients on the NHS.
Which is really nice, admirable. And what you've done for me in these last 2 years is you've always been a constant person on the other end of the phone and stuff like that, and it's really nice. And we're going to get into this, what, you know, how our relationship has developed and how my battle with bipolar has developed over the next 3 episodes. So strap in, it's going to get dark and ropey at times, and it's going to get, you know, light and airy at other times. But strap in. And really, where should we begin, do you think, with this story?
I think it would be nice to understand a little bit more about you growing up. So what it was like to sort of grow up on the streets of Walthamstow.
Grow up on the streets of Walthamstow. Yeah, massive. My childhood, I had a good childhood in terms of, like, I was happy for most of it. I was very active. I loved playing football. I boxed. I played rugby at times.
Mm-hmm.
I was very, like, sporty. I had lots of friends at school, and but deep down, you know, it was a broken home in terms of I was brought up predominantly by one parent, my mum. My dad.
Shout out.
Yeah, shout out to my mum,
Vicky.
And my dad was very abusive and violent.
Mm.
And so there was a lot of trauma mixed in with my childhood. You know, when I was 8 years old, actually, I was playing in my garden,
mm-hmm.
and my house, we had a tiny little London garden. I was playing there, and my house was in the shadow of a tower block, a big 11-story tower block. And I see actually a guy, a local dealer,
mm-hmm.
get chucked out of the 8th floor. And I never really thought of that at the time. I was like, I've just seen a geezer get chucked off a balcony.
That's a lot.
And so that was somewhat traumatic.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I had a lot of... I didn't really... See, my dad was abusive, and I've got some memories that have come up in the last few years that I've obviously been locked away, and that obviously were very detrimental to my mental health decline.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until a guy called Josh Connolly came into my life in the last couple of years. Like...
Mm.
I really do see myself sometimes in life of pre and post suicide attempts, because I've got so many beautiful people in my life that wouldn't have been in my life if I didn't attempt what I did.
Yeah.
And Josh is one of those. Josh, I came on my radar when he did a podcast that I listened to,
mm-hmm.
and he spoke about his abusive father.
Yeah.
And he said something that he would sit up on the top of the landing and you got to know the difference in thumps in terms of if your dad was hitting the wall, hitting the sofa, or hitting your mum's face. And when I heard that, it was like floodgates opened.
Mm-hmm.
And all these memories that mm-hmm. I had stored far, far away.
Yeah.
Because that was my life, sitting on top of the landing and just and hoping. My dad was a drug user.
Mm-hmm.
And if he couldn't get his drugs, he would get abusive and violent and smash up the house. And we never really had anything nice in the house mm-hmm. because it would be smashed up in a violent rage. And it was tough. And you know, and in a way I thank Josh for opening those memories because it means I can process them.
Mm-hmm.
But they're still not very nice. Like there's one that really I can't deal with is my dad was trying to get in the house and he was smashing where you said these glass panes in the door. He was smashing through the glass panes to try and unlatch the door.
Yeah.
And me and my sisters had an ironing board across the door. And then he was very strong. He overpowered us. So I just jumped on my mum and just was a human shield.
Mm.
I remember I was about 10, 11, 12, anywhere between. I was in primary school, but later years of primary school. And I remember getting a full-blown punch in the face.
Mm.
I had this big old shiner. And it was a horrible memory. It's a horrible memory that I still struggle with today.
Yeah, of course.
So there was trauma in my childhood.
You were there, I can sort of see it now on your face that it's very difficult to remember.
It is that one's very difficult to remember.
Did you at the time? I mean, that's a lot for a child to be experiencing and witnessing. I just wonder if it gave you like, did you feel a sense of kind of helplessness in that situation? Like, did you feel like you could?
It's hard because like you don't really know what you're feeling.
Yeah.
Your instinct is to try and protect your mum.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I felt helpless or anything, but I knew that I wanted to get hits if anyone. So
yeah.
And that was it. But I mean that is not all my childhood. That
yeah.
That is just a small part of my childhood. Other than that, you know, like I was, you know, we were very working class and mum was self-employed, so would struggle financially at times.
Mm-hmm.
And you could tell when she was struggling because a big sack of potatoes she'd come back with. And that was dinner and lunch for a week or,
yeah.
You know, she was very good at making meals stretch and stuff like that.
Mm.
But at the time, you don't realise that. Because that's just your childhood.
Yeah.
You don't realize that other people might be getting nice steaks every night because you don't and you don't care.
I love that. Like everyone's on the steaks.
Yeah, yeah. Like every family on the road is just dining on steaks and tartar, steak tartar. Oh, what's the posh food, the Tory stuff. Do you know what I mean?
Like never caviar, a fish finger in 100%. Sight.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, fish fingers. But you didn't realise. But, you know, I like I said, I just wanted to, I was obsessed with football. I still am. But that was my life, playing football every day. I would go and play football every day. And then mum would call me in and that was life. And it was a happy life. And
yeah,
we'd get the odd holiday to Spain. Like, because mum being self-employed, we didn't always get to go on holiday. But like sometimes she was a childminder.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes she'd have, you know, her books would be filled with children.
Yeah.
Which means we'd have a little bit more disposable cash.
Yeah.
And then we'd get a week in Spain. It wouldn't be anything. It would be like a self-catering shitty apartment.
But still, that was
like
the best.
Like, I'm going to Spain.
Yeah, 100%.
I'm like swimming in the sea every day.
Yeah.
And
you love a swim in the sea.
Well, unless it's really cold. Lara recently was like, you've got to go cold water swimming. It's gonna be amazing for you. And I was in there like, I'm going to kill this bitch. I I was
it takes a bit of time to acclimatise. Also, how did you get in? Did you like dunk in or did you do it very slowly?
I dived in.
Yeah, that's the right way.
That is the right way, but it was too cold. And I'm not doing it again. And it was choppy as well. And I might do it if it's like a lake.
Okay, we could go to a lake.
God, now I'm going to be going to lakes. But, you know, I'd get to swim in the sea and go on holiday, you know, I would say once every 2 years, maybe we'd afford a week in Spain. But, you know, you didn't know anything different. It was, I was happy. School was tough.
Yeah, what was school like? What was going on there?
School was, I was very popular because I was funny.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I am also dyslexic quite badly. To the point, like where P's and B's get mixed up.
Mm.
Yeah, Laura gave me her address once and I put it in the sat nav, it confused the hell out of me because it's PD or DP.
Keep that secret.
I was like, I don't even know if I'm going to the right house.
Yeah.
And because of my dyslexia, I really struggled in school. I was good at drama and PE. I was good at those because they are practical things.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what I am. And I do think it's unfair, the education system in this country and in you know, most of the Western world is, you know, we're all told to sit the same exams and then that's given a barometer of how intelligent we are.
100%, it's all based on the academic.
It's all based on that. Yeah. And some people are better at doing other somebody that's really academic and gets all A's in, you know, English, maths and science, you could be like, could you do whatever I do? Could you stand on a stage and make people laugh? No.
And it's also not an indicator of whether you're intelligent or not. I think that's really important to say. Like, you're very intelligent and you have to be a comedian to make people laugh and to pick up on things that other people wouldn't. But if you go by school grades,
not. And so, it, you know, it was my downfall because like I never got help, and I think it because I was popular as well. Where like it was hard. I think my mum picked up on it in later school, maybe about year 10, that I was dyslexic.
Right.
And she asked the school for help, but because I was, you know, like they gave me this test and they said, yeah, you're dyslexic. We can get you extra time in exams.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. But I didn't want to be going off the different hall with all the kids, you know, that had, you know, bigger special needs. And I was like, I'm cool. I don't need your help. And
yeah,
I can read, but like I read really slowly. And you know, I have to sometimes read a sentence 3 times before it's registered into my head. And one of the worst things in school I hated was when I don't know if they do it today.
Yeah.
But they would, in English, they would be like, right, we're going to all read a paragraph starting at the back of the class and work the way around.
Awful, yeah.
And it's such bad teaching. It's such bad practice. Because, listen, it's not the teachers themselves. They're taught to do it maybe that way because it wasn't just a particular...
They're trying to get, like, keep kids engaged in a way.
But for me, it would just make me panic and panic and panic. And what I used to do is I would work out my paragraph. All right, so I'm in 10 paragraphs time. I'll go, and then I would, in my head, over and over and over and over again, recite it like it was like, you know, like an acting job. And they were my lines. And
which I guess means you're then not listening. I don't know
what else been said. So then you hand an exam paper and said, what happened in that book? I said, well, I can tell you that one paragraph.
You're like, don't know, mice and
men. Of mice and men, classic, Killer Mockingbird.
Classics.
I'm like, these, and it was really tough because.
Do you think that affected your confidence at all?
It did. I read Sequel of Squirrel once and everyone laughed and it was like the worst thing that's ever happened to me. And like, I've now been lucky that I earn a, you know, I did before COVID, would earn a living from stand up.
Yeah.
And earn a living off making people laugh, but there's a difference. Making people laugh because you've said something funny, clever, and witty, or making people laugh because you've said, you know, the squirrel to the
sequel is a stupid word, but also, yeah, I get that. It's like there's a difference between people laughing at you versus kind of with you. And I, even though you're making your jokes as a comedian, yeah, that is laughing with you because it's under your control.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, but school was good. I think, you know, school for me was a good laugh. That's that's all it. I would go into school with this, like, you know, I'm going to make everyone laugh.
Yeah.
And that was my goal.
That was your first stage.
That was that. I remember the first time I made everybody laugh and I was like, I like that.
Mm.
And that was it then. I love the attention. I've always been naturally funny, and, you know, and that was my, I would go to school. That was my audience.
Mm.
But of course it would disrupt the class. The teachers didn't like me. Yeah. And it just made it, tough.
Yeah.
But you are in school and you're in school your whole life to lead up to your GCSEs.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like your whole, your primary school and you, and yeah, then everything goes on, you know, and they put so much pressure on these GCSEs.
Mm.
And it's fine because it's almost like one of those things of, oh, I'll deal with that tomorrow.
Mm.
In a way, like, we've all got those things like, oh, I've got something in July. Oh, yeah. And then next thing you know, mm, July is there. Mm, you know, mm, July is around the corner. And you're like, oh, I haven't prepared for that.
Mm.
And
why would you have been preparing at this point if...
Well, that's it, really, I suppose.
So what? How were the GCSEs and how were you feeling afterwards?
Oh, I hated it. So that was the first time... So immediately after, it was one of the years that my mum was doing all right. And she was with a partner that she's still with now at this point.
Mm.
So there was like two incomes coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And they took me to Spain for 10 days.
Yeah.
Straight after. You know, because after you finish your exams, you finish school then, aren't you? You get an extra long summer that year.
Yeah.
So it was literally, I think, 2 or 3 days after my last exam, we went to Spain for 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I didn't know what I was experiencing back then.
Yeah.
But now I know it very, very well. It's depression.
Mm.
I was suffering really bad with depression and I didn't know what was wrong with me because I was like, I couldn't get out of bed, fatigued. I felt so tired. I didn't want to do anything, even though I'm in this nice country of hot weather. And, you know, if we had a villa with a private pool, that would have been like, you know, the stuff of dreams for a 16-year-old.
Yeah.
Playing that all day. But I just didn't, I wasn't bothered. I just had this horrible, horrible feeling anymore or all the time.
Mm, what was that feeling?
It's a feeling that I'm, like I said, very, very familiar with now. And I, you know, and if I could describe depression, it would be this. I would, you know, when you touch your pockets and you can't feel your phone or your or your wallet or what, your bank cards or whatever.
Mm.
And for a split second, you're touching both your pockets frantically. And it's not there. So then you panic and your whole body kind of fills with this dread of, oh my God, I've lost my phone. Like, did I leave it on the bus? Where's my phone?
Mm-hmm.
And then you realize, oh, I just left it in the car. Like, oh, it's just in my bedroom.
Mm.
And then the dread instantly goes, yeah. Oh, it's in my bedroom.
Yeah.
Oh, of course. But that moment where you are feeling like just that kind of, oh, fucking hell. You're like that 24/7.
Mm.
Like you're constantly full of dread and you don't know why, because your phone is in your pocket but you are just feeling anxious and sad and like, oh my God, I can't afford a new phone. That feeling is exactly like depression.
Mm.
So anybody that has ever been lucky enough to never suffer a depression, that's it. That's as close as you'll probably get. And of course, everyone's going to have depression in different ways.
Yeah.
But that's the best way. If I could help somebody know that had never experienced it.
And I think that's important to articulate as well, because obviously this is talking about your experience of bipolar and depression being a part of that. And for other people, it might present differently. Like, you know, people might feel numb or just like constantly sad, but feeling that sense of dread at all times, it just must be
horrid. And I was 16, and I think it comes down to like your school's over now, and it's a real kind of like, oh shit.
Mm, Yeah.
What am I going to do?
Massive transition, yeah.
It is a huge transition in terms of I haven't got that comfort blanket of school and making people laugh and knowing that that's where I go and I don't have to earn money. And now what am I going to do?
Yeah.
And, you know, and I was already conflicted in terms of disagreeing with my mum after school. I've always been a performer.
Mm.
Whether my mum likes it or not, I've always been a performer.
Yeah.
And I can't help that. And when you come from like a very working class, single parent background, performing ain't really on the table.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
And I wanted to be an actor. And I wanted to go to drama school. And then my cousin offered, my cousin was working for this building firm and they offered me an apprenticeship as a plumber and apprentice.
Yeah.
And of course, mum wouldn't even allow me to think about being an actor. She just said, oh, you'll be like Billy Elliot. Like, right, you know,
yeah.
her idea of drama school is full of kind of posh people.
Yeah.
Like Billy Elliot. I mean, it might be. It probably is.
Yeah. And your mum's trying to keep you safe, I guess. She's trying to, she's going with what she knows.
Yeah.
But for you, I guess, well, that just was like, what you were good at.
I'm good at performing.
Yeah.
I'm good at, like, that's what I'm good at. I'm sorry. And
you don't need to be. This is the thing. Like, it's not a bad thing. It's nothing to apologize. It's a beautiful thing. Really is.
Yeah. And so you know, it's one of those things where I was then all this conflicted after school, and you know, waiting for the exams to come back, and I knew I didn't do well.
Yeah.
You can kind of, it's one of those things in life, you know, when you take any kind of exams, you get a gut feeling. If you did enough or not. And I didn't. And I mean, that was it. After I did take the plumbing apprenticeship and then the company, it was 2008 when I left school. And that was when obviously the massive financial crash happened.
Yeah.
And the company was only a small company and they went bankrupt.
Right.
So I was like left without an employer, and then you get with an apprenticeship, you get 1 day a week college, 4 days a week employment.
Right, yeah.
And you couldn't do college without an employment, and you couldn't. I couldn't find employment, so the college dropped me, which was shit.
Yeah, that is crap.
Yeah.
So like going from a system where you're at school every day, kind of like held in a sense, and then you're kind of in this world where, if you don't have X, then you don't get this.
And, you know, and then I was 17 and I went from like, you know, part-time job to part-time job in terms of all, you know, like a bit of everything really.
Yeah.
I worked in like home base and then bookmakers and when I was 18, but the depression wasn't really there at this stage. I suppose I was just like a 17, 18 year old that was kind of just, you know, earning part-time wage and then going down a pub and just, didn't really have much else.
So you felt all right around then, yeah.
And then like 18, I get a job with, in a pub, with my best mate and one of my closer mates as well.
Yeah.
And it was like World Cup 2010, we're 18.
Good times.
You know, they're showing all the games in the pub, like we're just pouring pints, we're having laughs with it. It was a great vibe. It was and of course that all comes to an end as well at some point. You know, you can't really stay there for a long period. And I went from job to job, and I started dating somebody when I was about 19, 20.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I was in this relationship, and I felt a little bit of pressure to, she's my ex now, but she came from like wealth or, you know, a comfortable family.
Yeah.
Is probably the word to use. You know, privately educated and, you know, both parents still together. I always see that as like, what are you doing still together?
Parents? Is it suspicious?
No, it's not suspicious. I just think it's a middle class thing.
I think, it's probably true, to be honest.
What are you doing still in love at 50? Get out of here. And I felt this like pressure. I wasn't good enough.
Didn't feel good enough.
No. You know, that stayed with me on and off throughout our relationship, which is something I regret. But about 22, I start feeling, 21 maybe.
Yeah.
I start feeling depression again.
Mm.
And this time it's hitting hard and erratically.
What do you mean by that?
When it hits, I'm like suicidal.
Mm.
Like contemplating suicide.
Mm.
And then it can go away.
Very unpredictable. So
like, bang. Yeah, it's very unpredictable. And of course, now in hindsight, this is the reason we're doing this podcast, because there are going to be people out there that are suffering with bipolar that don't realize.
Yeah.
And over the next 3 episodes, we're going to go really deep into that and how they can kind of maybe identify some symptoms and help them. But it was hitting. I didn't know why I was unhappy, because I was working for a bank at the time, and it was the best money I'd ever earned at that stage. And, you know, I had a girlfriend, I had a good job ish, you know, and
were you doing
like
that classic thing of like, I've got all these things, so I shouldn't be depressed.
Yeah.
Which I just want to say is like so common for people to say. And it's important to say that it doesn't matter what you have and what you're doing.
Well, no, yeah, it's one of the common things that people say. Like you hear sometimes maybe somebody that's very successful or wealthy sadly ends their life, and people will go, why did they kill themselves? They're rich.
Mm.
And it's like, it doesn't matter how rich or poor you are. Nobody is, you know, immune to depression and suicidal tendencies and stuff like that. And it's, but we do tick this box because that's what life tells us. Life tells us that we leave, we get a job, we buy a house, we get married, we have children, and we die.
Mm.
And that is so, honestly, that is so ingrained into us as a species that when you don't do that, me for example, I like to make people laugh.
Mm.
That's not a real job. I've still got friends to this day send me apprenticeships.
Mm.
Oh, my company's looking for an apprentice electrician. Mm-hmm. Are they?
Mm.
What do you want me to do about that? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, because it's ingrained in us that performing and stuff like that isn't a job.
Mm.
But I got this job at a bank, and my ex's dad used to work in a bank. So it was like, I'm gonna provide. Yeah. I'm gonna provide.
Yeah.
And I was very unhappy. And at this stage, it was like, I didn't know why. And I was like, I'm just actually putting myself back into that. I'm feeling some of what I was feeling in my head back then. Because I was like, I was overweight. I'm never underweight. But I was like, maybe a stone and a half, 2 stone heavier than I usually sit.
Mm-hmm.
Probably more 18 and a half to 19 stone.
Mm.
Which is big. And I thought that was it. Because you look for reasons. You look for reasons why you're depressed. And it wasn't the job, because that was earning me good money.
Mm.
That can't, it's impossible to be the job. The relationship was new, so we were like, you know, still very much kind of into on each other, very like infatuated.
Yeah.
What is it? Well, maybe because you hate your appearance, you're fat. If you lose weight, you'll be happy. So I went to the doctors and I was like, I'm really unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's because I'm fat.
Mm.
And they just gave me these tablets, and I know they were like laxatives, basically.
Wow.
And
at that appointment, did anyone ask you anything else?
No, you know, it's funny because it was a family doctor that was almost friends with my mum.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, and she was a lovely woman and she'd been seeing us since we was kids.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if it was like, for her, she didn't, it was just like, oh, take these, though, you know, you lose some weight. And
yeah.
But I briefly remember her saying, if these don't work, maybe we'll try antidepressants.
Okay, yeah.
But maybe it was like one of those things that she wanted to try these first, hopefully, you know, that would work. But they were horrible medication. Yeah. It was basically like every time you eat 10 minutes later, you'd go to the toilet.
And, that's not a fun life.
And I'm working in the bank at this stage, face-to-face with customers, having to run to the toilet. My managers had changed. Now, I had the manager that actually employed me, did my interview, employed me.
Mm.
And I think when your manager interviews you and employs you, she knows what she wants. She sees it in you. But then they had a branch switch up,
she
which
they
do.
She wants a bit of David Alfie Ward.
Wow. No one wanted a bit of David Alfie Ward back then.
She wouldn't be the first.
The thing is, I was so fat, it would like cave over my eyes so that you couldn't see him. Couldn't see him. That's my trick, the smize, isn't it?
Yeah, to be fair, if you haven't got your eyes,
yeah,
like...
I have just nothing. I'm joking. Nothing about my eyes. And the manager's changed.
Mm.
And I got this woman in that was a bitch, quite frankly. And there I am, sneaking into the rooms to cry sometimes and running to the toilet every 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Of course she doesn't want me to work for her, you know? So she made my life a living hell. Like if any bit of paperwork I did, if an I wasn't dotted and a T wasn't crossed, it would be pulled into the manager's, you know, if you do this again, you'll get a disciplinary and silly things.
Yeah.
So that wasn't helping. And I really didn't know what was wrong with me. And then I left the bank. And I went for a little while unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
And then guy that I go to Tottenham with was the manager of a lift firm. Like they supplied and fit lift equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, come and work for us. And I was like, yeah, that'd be a change.
Mm.
And then it was for a while because you always get that new.
Yeah.
But then because he was my friend, he was like more of an arsehole in terms of. No, he was, in terms of, like, he would shout across, like, my depression was getting really, really bad at this stage.
Yeah, what was going on for you with that?
I was constantly sad, and then, like, but the thing is, I'd never talk about the times that I was happy, I was high, because I was like, I'm a character, that's what I do. And then I would... So there was this room in the warehouse, the lift equipment warehouse.
Mm-hmm.
No one used to go in there, and you could lock it from the inside.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to go in there and sit behind the door, lock it from the inside, and cry and call Samaritans, because I was really suicidal at this stage, and I was really thinking about it, and I didn't know what was wrong with me. And I would be coming in more often than not depressed. I was getting very ill, because you'll know. That when somebody is suffering with bad mental health and poor ill mental health, it can affect the body.
100%. It's all. I think it's probably false to think about mental and physical health as separate things.
Yeah, and even I didn't know back then. No. I did. I wasn't savvy to it.
No,
because I was getting ill all the time. Like, I was getting tonsillitis. I'm talking 5 or 6 times a year. Now, that's a hell of a lot of times. You shouldn't get tonsillitis really ever.
Yeah.
And
you're very, very run down.
I was so run down. And I was having all this time off work, which made my friend who employed me angry at me. He would, like, as soon as he would be so, like, he would be a prick, to be quite honest.
Mm.
And then I would come in some days and I would feel really low, fatigued. I've always suffered with this fatigue.
Yeah.
Of just achy bones and achy things. And then he would shout across the warehouse, oh, watch out, everyone. Dave's depressed again.
Mm.
And I was like, yeah, I fucking am.
Mm.
I fucking am. That's why I'm ill all the time.
Mm.
Because I'm really fucking suffering.
Mm.
And it got too much at one stage. And I planned to end my life. I was going to go to the Lake District. Tottenham were playing a team up in the Midlands. And I went to watch that game. And then I was going to carry on the journey after the game to hang myself.
Yeah.
I got some rope and I made a noose. Put it in my boot. Watch Harry Kane score a free kick. It was a deflected free kick as well. It wasn't even that good. But the scenes were incredible. Last minute. Honestly, I don't think I'll ever see him score a free kick again. And that was it. I got in the car and I drove up to the Lake District. Had a cup of tea in a cafe. It's a beautiful part of the world. I don't know why I chose the Lake District. The Peak District is a lot closer. But yeah. Didn't do it and drove home.
Did at that time, did you reach out to anyone you knew? Did you speak to the Samaritans, anything like that?
Well, I was speaking to the Samaritans a lot in terms of, I was speaking to the Samaritans all the, like, whenever I was calling somebody. I'd call my friends as well, actually.
Yeah.
My friends, you know, I had a I've got a handful of friends that got, like, before 10 a.m. phone calls of me crying down the phone. Mm. And would say, what's wrong? And I'm like, I don't know. And it must have been hard for them to kind of witness, you know?
Of course. Did you speak to them about considering suicide?
No. No.
It's hard to talk to
people. It's very hard to talk to people. And I drove back from the Lake District to call my ex. And I was like, I'm ready to put this all behind me. And I'm going to just push it away.
Right.
And I'd started comedy as well at this stage. I started when I was about 21, 22. Wasn't doing it like, but it was also helped. Performing, as I've said before, it's always been such a release for me.
Yeah.
It's always been something I've very enjoyed doing. The sport and performing. So just starting stand-up, and I mean, I'm talking to like doing it open mics in pub function rooms to 10 people.
Yeah.
But it was like, oh, this is nice.
Did you get something from that?
Yeah.
Experience?
Yeah, it was really giving me a little beacon.
That's nice.
It was. It's always like, you know, stand up and where stand up has brought me in life and stuff like that. Mm. I've been very, very lucky. Mm. And sometimes, you know, I mean, it's cheesy, but it's like something finds you sometimes.
Yeah.
And stand up is very much like that.
Meant to be.
But I called my ex, and what I didn't actually say is before the Lake District and that, I had started to think I was a sex addict.
Mm.
And
why?
I think I got a bit of a release from sex and porn. Mm. And it's very common,
yeah,
with bipolar, that you think that you are a sex addict, or hypersexuality is very, very common.
Yeah.
So as much as I would sneak off to cry and call the Samaritans in the morning, when I was working in the warehouse,
mm-hmm,
I would sneak off to wank in the afternoon. And that was kind of porn and sex sites and that kinky side. I was like, because I really like this. And this is, you know, I just really need some kinky sex. And
so once again, you're almost like looking for a tangible reason or problem as to why you're feeling that way. I'm a sex addict.
You always are. You always are with anything in life. Like, you know, when something happens to you, you're like, why has this happened? Why is this happening?
Mm.
And that was, it was, it's just easy. So you know, I was fat. That didn't quite work out. And then it was like, I'm a sex addict. And that's why I wanted to kill myself, because I didn't know what to do. Because I was like obsessed with porn at this stage. With it. And
did you feel like embarrassed by that?
I tried to tell my ex-girlfriend at the time, and it was a bit like, she would, I don't know if she took it seriously. She probably thought like, he's like a young guy in his early 20s, of course he's obsessed with porn or whatever. But it was like, for me, it was like, it wasn't just the watching porn. Or the whatever else I was doing while watching porn. it wasn't just that act. It was the little bit of...
Was it a distraction?
Distraction.
How you were feeling?
Yeah. Mm. Same with stand-up.
Mm.
Same with, you know, later on, alcohol and...
Yeah.
These kind of little bits, they just distract you and they focus your mind on something else.
Yeah.
And it was horrible because I was... you know, I was... I don't know. It was a tough conversation to have with my ex, and that's when I was like, I kind of confessed to being addicted. I hadn't done anything in terms of just being on sex sites and stuff like that. And then I left.
Must have taken a lot to say that to your girlfriend at the time.
Yeah, the thing with me is I've always been quite. Well, I say that I've always been quite open and honest, but later on in the podcast, we'll find out that, you know, I got into myself into such a dark place that I wasn't that person.
Mm.
But the person I am now and the person I maybe was 5, 6, 7 years ago, I've always been quite honest. And yeah, it was tough. And that's why I was like, you get into this thought process, like, you know, I'm this fucking crying, wanking geezer. it's like people are much better. People would be better off without me, you know? And that's why I took myself to Lake District, and, you know, ultimately I didn't do it, and I tried to tell myself I can push all those feelings away.
Yeah.
And ultimately as we're gonna find out in later episodes that I couldn't. I mean, after that, I start to convince myself it's the job.
So it's like another thing.
That was the other thing. It was the job.
Yeah.
And
is this, you're still working at the lift firm?
Still working at the lift firm.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate it because, you know, my boss is a bit of a dick. And I convinced myself that that's what's making me up.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's so it's easier to do that and find these reasons than it is to actually face the truth of this could be deeper. Just like, and I'd been doing comedy, and, you know, we're a couple of years down the line now from Lake District, and I'd been getting pretty good at comedy, enough that I'm getting the odd paid gig now, you know, and it's the best feeling in the world to make people laugh or do what you love doing, truly love doing.
Yeah, that's
and somebody
cool.
to pay you afterwards.
I can see that in your eyes.
Yeah, because it's like, I'll do this shit for free.
Yeah.
And then so I'm like, just focus on, like, so I tried to do this documentary in America.
Hmm.
I drive across America with a couple of GoPros, and I'd stop and do shows at every destination I stop at. It's gonna call, just pop into the store. And I get in the metro, I get on TalkSport and stuff like that, all like self.
That's cool.
Like, yeah. And then I get my visa revoked because they think that I'm earning money, but I wasn't earning money.
Yeah.
But because it was in like the metro and on TalkSport and stuff like that,
yeah.
They were like, oh, this is a big deal. He should be getting like a fucking 10 grand visa for that. But actually it was just me, my ex and a GoPro, you know? So.
What a title.
Yeah. And, so I get this visa revoked. We both do. And there's nothing we can do. I get really drunk. I drink a bottle of whiskey. And I tweet Barack Obama asking for help, and he never got back to me. So, yeah, I know. Do you know, if you're listening now, Barack, I'll hold that against you. Piece of shit. But we lose a lot of money because that was going to be our traveling. So we'd kind of saved to do this documentary and travel America.
Yeah.
So we had this one-way flight to New York, and we'd lost, I don't know, a couple of grand, maybe, in stuff that we couldn't get back.
Mm.
So we call the airline, and we say, can we get our money back?
Mm-hmm.
And they said, nah, but we can give you a one-way to Bangkok instead.
Okay.
Just took it. We just took it, and I was like, I'm good enough now that I can pick up shows.
Yeah.
And,
that's cool.
And that's what we did. We spent the next 15 months around Southeast Asia. We was only briefly in Southeast Asia on our way to Australia. And then I do all these shows around the biggest comedy clubs in Australia. I really become a comedian there. Australia really made me the comic that I am.
Really?
Yeah, I owe a lot to Australia, really. And
shout out to the Aussies.
And so we do Australia, New Zealand. I pick up shows all the way around, and it kind of gets us some money as we keeps us fuel in the tank, kind of food on the table.
Yeah.
And then somebody gets wind of this guy called Eamon. Sorry, Eamon, forget your surname. Sad, sad, ads. And he runs a network of comedy around Southeast Asia called Mad About Comedy, from like Vietnam to Singapore, Indonesia, you know, Malaysia. He hears that there's this Brit doing really well. Obviously, somebody's told him. And he messaged me. He said, are you flying directly home? And I said, well, probably. And he said, like, well, we'll fly you to Singapore. And then we'll get you shows. And then we ended up doing shows with a guy called Phil Kay, who's a fantastic, like, hippie comedian. I love him to bits. And we do shows in, like, Brunei and Borneo and Jakarta and Bali. And we just... And it was just... amazing.
Sounds like it at the time, like it was going really well for you.
It was but it was when I was traveling and touring that I realized that there was something wrong with me. Like I remember doing a show in the Gold Coast, which is a beautiful part of Australia, and we had like this apartment on the beach kind of thing, and I remember being very, very depressed at the time, and
was it that sense of like dreading
the dread, and I didn't want to leave the room, and I kept the curtains closed, even though it looked out on the beach. Like I didn't want to leave. I cancelled my show. I said I wasn't feeling well, but it, you know, physically,
yeah.
And what it was, I was depressed, yeah, because about a week before, well, actually 3 or 4 days before, I'd been in Brisbane, and then I caught up with an old friend that I used to work in the pub in 2010, Stu, and we always got on really well, me and Stu. And we spent the day together. We went to a theme park. I was telling you before we started recording that I love theme parks. So me, Stu, and my ex went to theme park, and it was just the best fucking day.
Yeah.
And then I had a gig that night. Stu came with some friends. We all went out and got got drinks. And of course, that caused me to go a very like euphoric high, because I was seeing an old friend. I was having a really good time with good people, and with bipolar, my crash came when I was in the Gold Coast less than a week later. And that's when I knew something was wrong with me, though. That as much as I was at all this Australia, New Zealand, Southeast Asia, and then when I get home, I'm flown pretty much straight back out to South Africa. Like, this is when my career really took off.
Yeah.
I knew there was something deeper. And it's only when I first, you know, we get back from all those tours, we were around for about 15 months. And like I said, I get home, I fly straight out to Amsterdam for a show, fly back and I fly to South Africa for 2 weeks. And I do a tour of Cape Town, Durban and Johannesburg, chauffeured. It was like 5-star hotel chauffeured. And
nice, yeah.
It was like, but it's this kind of like the feeling you get from that. And then I fly back and, you know, it's about 2016, 2017. And this is, you know, the next episode. We're gonna wrap this up in a second, but that's when after the traveling and the touring, that's when shit really hits the fan in my life with my mental health and coming back and really realizing that I had something quite seriously wrong with me. So yeah, I think that's about right. We leave it there. We've gone through childhood and all the way up to 2017, really, but it's the next episode where, you know, I'm obsessed with suicide. I'm obsessed with you know the release that suicide is going to give me and the pain that I'm feeling, and I, you know, medicating myself in various different ways.
Yeah.
And it was the worst time of my life, to be quite honest.
Something to look forward to next episode.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been good. Thank
you. Yeah, it's been nice. Now we're going to wrap that up then. Say goodbye, Laura.
Goodbye.
You have been listening to David Alfie Ward, Bipolar and I, a Cabin Fever original podcast.